Hello and welcome back to another edition of NAEMT Radio. I'm your host, Rob Lawrence, and we're getting up there in terms of episodes and editions. We're heading towards episode 30, and we do two a month. So we've been going for a year and a bit now. So it's pretty cool that the podcast is developing as it is. So today's topic is to talk about antibiotics for open fractures. And to help me tell that story, I'm delighted to welcome two esteemed guests. One of them has been on before, is a returning guest, and that's our own medical director, Dr. Doug Coopas. And also, I'd like to welcome Dr. Joey Johnson, who is an associate professor of orthopedic surgery and director of clinical research at the University of Alabama in Birmingham, or if you're listening internationally, Birmingham for those across the pond. And there's a British connection here, of course, because Dr. Johnson also worked in the UK for a little while, and maybe we'll talk about that later. Doctors, welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to be here, Rob.
I'd like to start the podcast with a little bit of an explainer. And as I was saying to you before we hit record, of course, we have an amazing association with a range of ability in terms of certification, qualification, understanding. So, Dr. Johnson, just kind of kick us off with the kind of explainer of open fractures and, of course, then the application of antibiotics. And then we'll drill down a little deeper into it.
Sure. So an open fracture is any fracture or break of the bone that comes through the skin and is exposed to the environment. They most commonly happen in the lower extremity, just below the knee, just because of the soft tissue envelope there, but they can happen really anywhere. And there's been a pretty substantial amount of information and literature that's been published that giving antibiotics prophylactically, so before any sort of infectious complication sets up for open fractures, decreases your rate of infectious sequelae. So your chances of developing either a superficial infection or a deep infection are both decreased by giving prophylactic antibiotics. And that information dates all the way back to the 70s. We've gotten a little bit more sophisticated with how we've looked at it here in the last few years. But this is like a long-standing, well-known thing within the world of orthopedics and emergency medicine, is that antibiotics for fractures that come through the skin, given prophylactically, help improve patient outcomes.
Dr. Coopas, obviously, is our medical director. We're doing a lot more pre-hospitally these days as technology and ability and increase. And so we're doing whole blood out there and now antibiotics for open fractures. Clearly a good thing for us.
Yeah, absolutely, Rob. I think that, you know, this is there's an increasing trend here. I have been referring to this as yet another time-sensitive illness. We think of time-sensitive illnesses in EMS, and we generally think of STEMIs and acute strokes, acute high-end trauma. But you know, this really is a time-sensitive illness where EMS has the opportunity to do yet another intervention that's indicated and get it on long before the patient even gets to the hospital to get the intervention.
In some of your work, Dr. Johnson, you talk about the timeliness of this intervention, but you know, there are clearly some risks, some infection risks, and certainly the research you've done, you know, you indicate the kind of the percentages that we need to think about. And so, you know, talk about that timeliness and really to obviously, where we want to go from here is to encourage people to become involved, to enroll, or to do this procedure. Let's start by highlighting the risks. If we don't,
yeah, I think the, I mean, when you're taking a look at the vast body of literature on open fractures, specifically in the tibia, they have the highest infection rate. So that's kind of what we refer to this. So open fractures of tibia have an infection rate up to about 20%, just depending on what literature that you read. And that can have a cost to the system of hundreds of thousands of dollars and years off of ability to work for the patient, right? So this is a huge burden for both the health system and the patient in general. And we've known historically that giving patients antibiotics prophylactically decreases their infection risk and the rate of infection. But recently, really in the past 6 or 8 years, we've been able to drive that down and figure out when that window of giving them antibiotics is most effective. There's actually a study that was done in Charlotte that showed for grade 3 open tibia fractures. So those are the most severe open tibia fractures, the ones that are most likely to have infectious complications, that the window for giving them antibiotics to really drive down those infection rates the most was in the first 65 minutes after injury. So if you're taking a look at like how long transport times take from the field to the ER, you can really kind of think to yourself the amount of impact that EMS providers can have in helping drive down those infectious sequelae and preventing negative complications from these injuries for patients. But all of that data has kind of been certainly in the last 10 years, but really kind of in the last 6 or 7 that we've really been able to get a handle on the critical nature of early administration of antibiotic prophylaxis for open fractures.
And I'm excited these days because the level of pre-hospital research from various organizational bodies is on the up. And maybe 10 years ago, that wasn't so much the case. But all of the pre-hospital studies, I think, pretty much support what you've just said.
For sure. And I think there have been several, right? But I think the two most cited ones are in areas where they're actually able to give pre-hospital antibiotics. One of those was in Charlotte, and then there's one across the pond in England, which actually showed that giving pre-hospital antibiotics within the NHS was an effective measure to decrease time to antibiotics. And when you take a look at like the specificity of EMS providers diagnosing open fractures just without x-rays, which is like looking at a patient and saying, oh, I see bone, like limb is bent, that specificity is anywhere from 65 to 95%, just depending on the study that you look at. So it's actually better than one would expect, right? So like EMS providers, even though they're not diagnosticians, still do a really good job of identifying who would benefit from this intervention. And I think that's one of the key things here is that, yes, the EMS world has expanded greatly in terms of what you can do pre-hospital. But I think this is one of those things that the diagnosis of it is quite straightforward. And the administration of the antibiotics is straightforward as well. And I think it is really an opportunity for EMS providers to really affect positively patient outcomes. They already do it in tons of other ways. And I think this is another way where they're really kind of able to help out patients in the long term.
So taking it back to the requirements on our providers, Doug, clearly there's the education, the understanding, and the training in order to do this isn't so much of a great leap.
No, it's not much of a leap at all. And I think most of the hurdles have been removed recently. One of the things that we always have to think about is this even on the scope of practice for paramedics or practitioners within any given state? And we don't have a great handle on that, but we do know of many states where it is. In Pennsylvania, we did we have statewide protocols, and we have a statewide protocol for this. And we did a pilot project over about a year prior to having it go statewide. And that was a statewide pilot project. And, same kinds of things. We collected data on the accuracy of the diagnosis of an open fracture. And it was actually far above the 95% that was just stated. You know, EMS clinicians can determine when these are an open fracture. And we're not talking about fractures where it's obvious and the bone is sticking out and it's looking right at you. It's those, there's deformity, you're pretty sure there's a fracture, and you've got a laceration or puncture over the wound. That's going to be an open fracture. And EMS is really good at diagnosing them. The cost of the antibiotic, the most commonly used one is cefazolin, and the cost of that is down to a couple dollars. In the past, that was always a concern, is that maybe it's going to cost too much to do that. And I will point out, Rob, that at this past EMS World in New Orleans, there was a poster presented and the abstract is published that showed indeed that EMS is quite capable of getting this on well in that hour's window after the injury. And in a group of over 1,000 administrations of antibiotics, the pre-hospital time from injury to getting to the hospital was about 47 minutes. So when you think about that, there's no possible way that most hospitals are going to get that patient arrived, checked in, and get antibiotics on board in the very small time they have left in that hour. So EMS really has to do it. And the poster at EMS World showed what we're seeing in Pennsylvania, which is in about a half hour from injury, not from EMS being arriving on scene, but from injury, EMS is able to, on average, get the antibiotics in within that half hour.
Great. Well, you answered, as many people know, I'm a recovering chief operating officer these days, and as opposed to an active one. And of course, the standard COO question was, who the hell's paying for this? How much does it cost? You've just addressed that. So the cost is probably negligible. It sounds like, though, we just need to do a little survey to see who has this statewide in their protocol and who doesn't, and perhaps therefore suggest some additions and some amendments if necessary to enable this at least to be considered to be implemented, I suspect. So there's probably a little association level to do there, Doug.
Yes, and I will tell you that, you know, when it started in Pennsylvania, it started because there was a presentation at NSEMSO's medical director group. The state of EMS officials, the state EMS medical directors. And at the time, the medical director from Indiana presented on a program that they were doing there. That wasn't statewide. It was just with a single agency. But, you know, years ago, there were pockets of places that had started to do this. I think it has spread dramatically. But I think the project from last year that was presented showed that there is still a lot of opportunity because it's only a small number of the fractures that were identified that get pre-hospital antibiotics yet today.
Before we go any further, we're just going to take a quick break and have a word from our friends about EMS on the Hill.
Since 2010, EMS on the Hill Day has brought EMS professionals together in Washington, D.C. to advocate for the needs of our patients and the EMS profession. Join us on Capitol Hill from April 17th and 18th, 2024, to visit with congressional leaders and staff to help them understand the needs of EMS in our communities and states, especially during this critical time. We'll begin with a pre-Hill briefing to meet as a group, hear the details of our request to Congress, and answer questions. Hill Day includes both seasoned advocates and first-time EMS advocates, so it's a great opportunity to network, learn, and gain insight on the federal legislation and its impact on state legislative efforts. Register today. The fee is only $20, which includes two receptions and congressional scheduling services.
Thank you very much. That was the smooth voice of Chief Julius Jackson talking about NAMT on the Hill, which is coming up rapidly. And if you haven't booked your place yet, we recommend that you do, because we need to have you on the Hill talking to our elected officials on the day. And so I look forward to seeing you there. I know, Dr. Cooper, you're going to be there as well. And so let's have a great day of legislating and pushing for change in our industry. And so we're talking about antibiotics for fractures, and I'm delighted to welcome back, of course, our medical director, Dr. Doug Coopers, and Dr. Joey Johnson. And so one of the things that you picked up on when we were having the sort of pre-chat, Dr. Johnson, is really some of the position statements on pre-hospital antibiotics. And you make a number of recommendations, but I think it's just worth highlighting those, if you wouldn't mind doing that for us.
Sure. So the COT and the OTA jointly put together a position statement on this, which is in the process of publication now. But the recommendations that came out of it through a review, a pretty thorough review process, and then editing from, I think it was like 13 different societies, including NAMESP and the OTA and the COT. And then I think there are two other emergency and pre-hospital health organizations that were involved in that. What came out of it was there were four general recommendations that could be made based on the literature. Those are that in a responsive patient with no history of a penicillin allergy, the administration of a first generation cephalosporin, we'd just talked about, right, that the most commonly given one is cefazolin, which is what we'd be referring to here, should be performed after management of life threats in patients with a suspected open fracture. If the patient is obtunded with a protected airway, then the recommendation is the same. In a responsive patient with a documented penicillin allergy, the administration of a first-generation cephalosporin is still recommended. And then the key here, though, is that administration of antibiotics should not delay transport to a trauma center or any other life-saving interventions, right? This is a very important thing. We want to make sure that we're taking care of patients' musculoskeletal issues, but we're not going to be recommending that it be done at the cost of any other intervention. Just to be clear, we didn't really think that anyone would take it that way, but we just want to make sure. So those are will hopefully be published soon. But those were the main takeaways from that particular paper.
And I always say, or I've always said that it's a bit like gunshot wounds, that these things are surgeons' injuries and not ours. And therefore, we need to get on there, stabilize, and get off there. And obviously, we shouldn't interrupt that sort of train of thought. Of course, when dealing with antibiotics and administering antibiotics, of course, there's always the allergy issues, Doug.
Yeah, so Dr. Johnson alluded to that a little bit. And, you know, over the years, I think that we don't want to underestimate the importance of a severe allergic reaction, but we typically have overplayed that, I think, and been overly cautious in many situations about giving people appropriate antibiotics when the risk wasn't there. And you know, as I alluded to the study that was presented as an abstract at EMS World, and in that case, in over 1,000 administrations of antibiotics for open fractures by EMS, the group looked for administration of epinephrine by the same EMS team as an indicator of an allergic reaction that might have ensued. And there wasn't a single case of any of those patients who needed epinephrine for a severe allergic reaction. So I think that, you know, it is very, very safe. It's played out. This is exactly what the emergency department is going to do when the patient arrives, is give that same antibiotic, unless they have a documented severe allergic reaction. Generally, these are safe to do.
So I think for the last 20 minutes or so that we've been talking, this is clearly a procedure that is well within our ability to do. To administer. The training and education levels are, again, within the potential scope of practice. Obviously, we just need to work out if it's within the scope of practice by state and by location, but that's probably easily fixed. And so I don't want to use the word no-brainer, but perhaps I'm going to, that this is clearly something that we need to be adopting in a wholesale and widespread method.
I agree with that, too. I think There is some dissenting information out there that people will occasionally bring to the table when we're discussing this. There were two studies that come to mind. One was a study that was actually published in JTACS, which subsequently had a retraction that actually had to have a lot of their conclusions walked back. But they essentially looked at patients that received antibiotics prior to hospitalization or during hospitalization. There is no time point associated with a decreased infection rate. But the problem with the study was it was done using NIS data. And so it was essentially only patients that developed an infection during their initial hospital stay, which essentially excluded about 95 to 96% of the study population. So it was a study that was essentially biasing itself towards patients that had prolonged hospitalization who were going to have a higher level of infection rate anyway. And so you kind of lose some of the information in the wash there. And so based on that, it was actually like two letters to the editor were published and the authors ended up changing some of their conclusions. So that particular study, I think it was done with the best of intentions, but I think it was inherently flawed to begin with. And then the other one is what actually came out of the NHS and was published in Injury. And it was part of called the Tibia Project, where they looked at how national guidance in the NHS had changed antibiotic administration rates in pre-hospital settings. And they had actually shown that using antibiotics in a pre-hospital setting in the NHS had decreased time to antibiotics, but they didn't show any decrease in infection rate. But when you actually drill down on their numbers, it was because of a systems issue that they were having. So prior to pre-hospital antibiotics, they were giving patients antibiotics the average time to antibiotics was 3 hours after injury. And then after they had started the pre-hospital administration, it went from 180 minutes to 160 minutes. So the 20-minute time difference that they saw was well outside of what you would expect to really make a difference. And so both of those studies, I think, were done for good reasons, but I think neither of them really kind of demonstrate any weakness to the thought that giving antibiotics really helps. And if anything, I think the second one actually kind of proves the point, right? So if you're well outside that window, decreasing your time to antibiotics isn't going to help if you're at like 3 or 4 hours. What you really want to be doing is getting it as soon as possible. But I think it's important to note both of those papers are out there because it will get brought up, especially as you start to try to get more state organizations on board. Everyone's going to have pushback at some level at some point. And I think when they start putting data out there, it's just important to know about those, because I can tell you from writing a position paper, they will come up.
And Rob, you know, to your point of widespread use, and is it time for widespread use by EMS? You know, I think there's always this balance, right, between, you know, there are people that say, oh, if they're going to do it at the hospital, or if the hospital is going to do it, we should do it in EMS if we can. I don't fully subscribe to that, because I think there are some conditions where there are nuances, and there are things that, you know, maybe some additional diagnostic studies or things can determine if somebody needs something or not, and there might be bigger risk. This I view more like the aspirin for STEMI or suspected coronary syndrome. You know, we know that the preponderance of the evidence shows that it is beneficial. We know that it is extremely low risk, and we know that it's relatively inexpensive and easy for EMS to do. And yes, as soon as they hit the door at the hospital, they're going to get it. So it makes sense to me to do it earlier. I think this is in that same category. You know, we know that the hospital is going to do this for open fractures. If someday later there's a good study to show that it's really not necessary, that's a different case. But if the hospital is going to be driven to a get it in within 60-minute time frame, then EMS ought to do it, because it is relatively easy, it's within the capabilities, and it's relatively inexpensive.
Actually, I'm just going to pick up on things that you both said there. Just talking about the research, one of my favorite lectures at our annual Gathering of Eagles conference is actually the session on research that you should pay attention to, and then research that's possibly got some holes in it, and here's why. And I think perhaps we're now overdue, certainly on NEMT radio, having the likes of Dr. Renkowitz and Crow and Dave Page, etc., in on how to read and understand research, because not all research is created and presented equally. So I've got that on my to-do list. And points well made, Dr. Cooper, particularly around, you know, why should we do it pre-hospitally? We spend a lot of time when we're talking to elected officials talking about, and if we don't do this, lives will be lost and we can save more lives. I think this particular procedure increases the quality of outcome and the quality of life. It may not be life-threatening, but actually we can alleviate a lot of suffering, pain, and longer-term, you know, conditions, etc. So I think this makes absolute sense. So thank you for making those points. And just a reminder to everybody that the references that we're talking about will be in the show notes, and so you can read and click through on all of that. So as we get close to time, my classic Rob ending question, as always, is there anything I've forgotten to ask or anything that you want to tell us?
I mean, I think the big thing here, we kind of stressed again, but the benefit of this intervention, when you take a look at the scope of practice of EMS, I mean, the cost of putting whole blood on a truck is exorbitantly more than antibiotics. Granted, antibiotics in this case are not going to save someone's life, but they will improve their quality of life, which you just pointed out. So it's inexpensive. You don't even have to have a refrigerator. It's within the scope of anyone's practice who can start an IV. And the biggest thing is, as Dr. Cooper's pointed out, it's incredibly safe. A lot of the old data on penicillin cross-reactivity has been refuted by the studies he pointed out. And we now know that it was all of the older studies from the 70s and 80s looking at penicillin cross-reactivity were because of the contaminated batches of cephalosporin. And so with all of that in mind, again, don't want to call it a no-brainer, but it's as close as we can get from an orthopedic standpoint. And I know that EMS providers do have the downside of not being able to see long-term outcomes of the patients they take care of. But this is definitely an area where they can really point to and say, I'm impacting someone's life well down the road from after the time they leave the hospital.
And actually, that's the exact reason that you're on this podcast, because you are downstream. You are seeing the downstream effect. So thank you for joining us. And actually, before I come to you, Dr. Cooper, for your last thoughts, that, whole blood, of course, yeah, there is that expense piece. And actually, on my to-do list as well is also to write about the logistics of whole blood, because people are talking about the benefits of doing it, but there's a whole setup logistic funding issue. And actually, Dr. Matt Levy has just produced an amazing paper that drills into that detail. And so coming up soon, from whatever outlet I present it on, I'm going to actually drill into that piece, because I think people need to know the how-to as well as, or how to get it going. And I think that's a piece where I've had many questions from folk on is, you know, where do we start? Well, I'm trying to explore that and explain it. So that's coming up. Your final thoughts, Dr. Kubas?
Yeah, Rob, I think for my final thoughts, I would put in a little bit of an advertisement, or I guess for you, maybe an advertisement. The NAEMSP is in the process of writing an evidence-based trauma compendium. Many people might have seen the airway evidence-based compendium that was done 2 years ago. Well, PEC will be publishing a trauma compendium that's going to cover all topics of trauma related to EMS, from, you know, evidence-based new looks at how we handle a trauma cardiac arrest and that sort of thing. But, you know, this obviously will be covered in that section too, to review the evidence and some position statements around that from NAMSP. So I think your audience can look forward to many good evidence-based trauma articles, including related to this topic, coming out soon from NAMSP.
So I'll put all the contact links in the show notes of how we can follow our guests today and obviously all the work that they have talked about and presented. But for the moment, thank you both very much for joining us on NAMT Radio. We are edging towards, as I've said, EMS on the Hill, if you listen to this in the time that it goes out. Don't forget that NAMT Radio is published twice a month, usually on the 1st and the 15th of the month, for you to keep up with whatever is going on across the National Association of EMTs. And we'd love you to join if you're just listening and you're not a member. Of course, visit naemt.org for everything you need to know about the association, membership, and of course, our amazing medical director, Dr. Kupas. But for the moment, thank you both very much. This has been another edition of NAMT Radio. I've been your host, Rob Lawrence, and until next time, bye for now.